playing for the American League Championship. I don't believe it. It just continues. My
oh. High fly ball into right field. She is gone.
Oh, drives one. Right field. Did he do it? He did. Are you kidding me?
The FSS Plus podcast rolls on, and folks, welcome to my show. I am the captain now. No. I am the captain now. I'm alone today. Jason has decided to take this Thursday, March 21st off after ingesting too much dairy last night. He texted me this morning and said, I can't get out of bed, and when I do, it's not good for anybody. That's why Jason's not on. Jeremy Booth, obviously a very, very busy man. Couldn't get him away from his responsibilities, and you know, I won't sugarcoat it. I asked 15 people to co-host this episode with me, and I got 15 non-responses. So that kind of speaks to where things are at in my career and my reputation. The FSS Plus podcast rolls on another week, another narrative for your listening pleasure. It is NL East week at FSS Plus. We're going to talk about the Braves, the Marlins, the Mets, the Phillies, the Nationals, and why you, yes, you, the listener, may soon be starting a game for the Miami Marlins on the mound. Not good. Yeah, news out of Miami, not good. Also, as we have done every week, I am going to give you two or three series this weekend that you should be paying attention to as a college baseball fan and a observer or general proprietor of the MLB draft. Yeah, my word choice all over the place. Let me slam a little bit of this coffee here and we'll get pumping, guys. All right, that's your ASMR for the day. The NL East, we'll do a couple of matchups. But before we do that, this past week on Monday, we released our 2024 MLB draft update. And it was a pretty big update. I mean, obviously we re-racked the board entirely, but I think even more importantly, we came out with a new feature this past week called Stockwatch. And that Stockwatch feature has been welcomed by all you readers, and we really appreciate you guys taking some time to read what amounted to 39,000 words over 300 players. I said this on my own podcast on Overslot. My wife has grown weary of baseball. She's not a huge fan of how I spend all of my spare time writing about teenagers. But here we are. Here we are. So let's talk about this top 300 update. I'll tell you a little bit about what I'm hearing inside the industry and kind of what moves the needle here, both at the top and kind of in the you know, in those sandwich areas, the thickness of the board. Travis Bezzana moves from number 3 to number 1 in this class. Now, one thing that you're going to learn about me, and it's something that I take great pride in as a draft evaluator, I'm generally not swayed. I mean, slightly. Of course, we take into consideration industry conversations. I'm not just going to sit here and act like our board isn't built without some guidance of the folks that are on, you know, backfields and behind chain link fences every single day. I wouldn't be doing my job if I wasn't using my networks. But I really like to stick to my guns. If I believe something in the draft, if I believe something when I'm evaluating a player, I generally stick to it. And I think that's visible last year as I had, you know, I had Kyle Teal, the number 7 player in the draft. I had Arjun Namala, the number 8 player in the draft. And while those two guys went, you know, Teal went 12 or 13 to the Red Sox, and Arjun Amala went 20 to the Blue Jays. Colt Emerson, another example. I think I ended up with Colt Emerson at 12, and he ended up going 22 in the draft to the Mariners. I generally stick to my guns. It's not that I'm stubborn. It's that in this industry, scouting and evaluation and being public in how I do it, if you don't have an opinion, what do you have? You're really just regurgitating what someone else believes. And if that's what you're in this industry for, and you're in it for the news, not the growth and the learning, you're gonna flame out and burn out on it pretty quickly. So Travis Bezzana, before I get too far on a tangent, the number one player in the 2024 class, he leapfrogs J.J. Weatherholt, who has missed essentially the entire year with a hamstring injury, and Nick Kurtz, who is off to a slow start. I don't want to jump to conclusions with Nick Kurtz. Off to a slow start and then banged up his shoulder this past week, so he falls slightly. But here's the thing with Travis Bezzana. And everyone that I've talked to, I mean, truly, this is kind of a look behind the curtain. I would say it's 70-30. Most people have Charlie Condon, the number one player in the class. And I see it. I understand why. I mean, the guy's 6'6", 220 pounds. He's playing a strong left field. He's playing center field. He looks like he could be a solid average right fielder. He's played a strong third base where he could end up playing there. For me, I've known Travis Bezzana, not, I guess, kind of personally, but I've known him as a baseball player since he was 17 years old. I've talked to Travis Bezzana at least once a year for the last 3 or 4 years. Nobody impresses me more than Travis Bezzana. He is, I think, he stands alone as the most impressive cerebral thinker in the baseball space. If there was one person in this draft that I would put my mortgage down on becoming a 3 to 3.5 win player, it's Travis Bezzana. Now, I'm not saying that Travis Bezzana has the ceiling that Charlie Condon does. And actually, I would probably say that, you know, Condon has star potential. I think Charlie Condon could turn into a 5.5 win player. I believe that. I think he could hit 260 with 40 home runs. He's a really impressive specimen, and he still has projection left in that frame, and that's not something you can say about Bezzana. He's 6 foot, already a 200-pound frame. But Bezzana has only ever hit, whether it's on the Cape with a wooden bat, whether it's at Oregon State, whether it's in the West Coast League, as a 17-year-old playing against fully grown college men, all he's done is hit. He's left-handed. He's a thinker. He's into the numbers. He's into the metrics. He's into the data. I'm just fully convinced that Travis Bezzana is going to be a steady, if not spectacular, pro. Condon does come in at number two. And I prefaced Condon at the top by saying in another 5 or 6 weeks, Charlie Condon may hold the top spot on this board. I didn't want to jump to conclusions for myself personally. Condon had quite a bit of swing and miss in his game last year, and he hasn't nailed down a specific defensive role that I think anybody is like truly comfortable throwing that profile on. Is he going to be a 45 third baseman? Maybe. Is he going to be a 50-plus right fielder? Maybe. Is he going to be a 50-plus left fielder? Maybe. Is he going to be a 40 center fielder for the early part of his career? Is he going to be a Michael Saunders in center field? Maybe. Maybe early. Is he going to be Chris Bryant? Is he Nick Castellanos? Nobody really knows. You know, Condon was so good in 2023, and he's always flashed the impact 70 grade raw power, and the hit tool has come along this year, but I just want to see him continue to bludgeon arms in the SEC, make me believe that against premium competition, this thing has taken a considerable step forward. I fully surrender to the fact that Condon probably has the most star potential on the college side in this class. But for me, if the draft was today, if I'm making a pick, I'm taking Bezzana. I'm taking Travis Bezzana, the above average center fielder, the solid average second baseman, the plus hitter, the above average power, the solid to above average runner who could steal 25 bags and hit 25 bombs. That's where I'm going with my first pick. As we work down the top 10, JJ Weatherholt falls just to number 3. I would really like to see him get back on the field soon, although hey, you know, we're at close to a month without JJ Weatherholt, and I'm really beginning to think when he does come back, he's just going to DH. West Virginia needs him in the lineup. To have a shot this year, to reach their goals as a program, West Virginia needs JJ Weatherholt in the lineup. I have a hard time believing that they are being ever so patient to get him back at shortstop when the bat could play right away. So it wouldn't surprise me at this point if JJ Weatherholt doesn't play another inning in the infield this season. I mean, it really wouldn't. We're going on close to a month where he has not played a game. And we haven't heard about him coming back anytime soon from the team. So Weatherholt's at 3. I think he's got the potential to fall a couple more spots, but I do think considering how twitchy he is and what he did in 2023 and just generally the strength of this class, I have a hard time believing JJ Weatherholt makes it out of the top 10. Braden Montgomery was 4 for me, a former Future Stars guy. I like the switch-hittedness. I like the raw power. I like the tools in right field. He can run a little bit. I think he presents... The reason I went with Montgomery at 4 is I think he presents a bigger and better crayon box of tools than a lot of the other guys that you'll find in the top 10. And because of that dynamic ability, I'm bullish on the hit tool and the power taking a step forward. I wanted Braden Montgomery to be number 4 in this class. Jack Caglione, all of his metrics have improved this year, but he's still chasing at a pretty high rate. Still don't think he's an arm despite having a very good start to the year from the left side. I still think that he's going to be what will amount to an average defensive first baseman with elite power upside. You know, you've heard the Matt Olson comparisons. I don't think it's out of the question. But Caglione is probably never going to provide exorbitant value either on the base paths or with the glove. And I personally don't know if Caglione is even going to end up being a... even an above average hitter with his approach. I think it's probably an average hit tool with 70 grade power, and that's pretty much where the value of his profile ends up. But at the end of the day, what I just described is a 265 hitter with 40 home run power, and you get that at 5, you're stoked. Connor Griffin comes in at number 6. I'm buying the tools here. I'm buying the tools because the options for me here, it came down to Griffin, it came down to Nick Kurtz, and it came down to Chase Burns. And I tell you, Chase Burns is probably 3 or 4 more just dominant outings away from being in my top 5 or 6. He could go really, really early. But Connor Griffin is the ceiling play, right? He's the high volatility. He's the guy that is going to provide a ton of value at shortstop or in center field. He's going to flash plus raw power. He's going to flash a plus throwing arm. He's going to show plus speed. And you hope that the hit tool for Griffin, who is running like an 800 on base percentage in Mississippi, mind you, you just hope that the hit tool is strong enough to allow those tools to stand out. So he hasn't done anything to dissuade me away from the player in the top 10 of this class. And I have a hard time believing that he makes it too far in this draft. I just think in a draft lacking the tools that it lacks, Griffin stands out for the five tools. I had Nick Kurtz 7. I didn't feel like I felt it was a little too early to ding him entirely and put him behind a pitcher. I still think this guy is a really, you know, a number 3 hitter at the big league level. Jim Tomei-esque left 6'5", 240. You know, he's still putting together good swings. He's still not chasing outside of the zone. And when he does find the barrel, it's just as loud as it's ever been. But with Kurtz, you know, the thing is the contact quality hasn't been there. There's been a lot of weak fly balls, a little late to left field or on the infield. And I think that'll clean itself up once he gets back. Expected back probably around Easter So Nick Kurtz, number 7 in this class. And then you get to the college pitchers. Chase Burns has been one of the most impressive college pitchers that we've seen in some time. He's been just as good as Paul Skenes to this point in the season. Mostly a two-pitch guy for the time being. I would like to see whether or not he's going to bring that changeup out much at all in ACC play. But he is looking more and more like a guy that teams would be plenty comfortable selecting in the top 5. Hagen Smith, he's been every bit as good as Chase Burns if you eliminate that first start, and his handedness might ultimately push him over the edge for teams trying to decide between Smith and Burns. Smith particularly still showing fringy control of the baseball. I'd like to see him really put together a few starts where he's keeping that pitch count low, where he's not walking batters, and he's slicing and dicing up the competition. And then I have Seaver King 10. And I'll tell you, like I said, there are teams that will always model athleticism and dynamic ability at the top of any class. Wouldn't surprise me at all if Seaver King jumped all of these cats. I mean, jumped over Jack Caglione. I jumped over Braden Montgomery. I could see a scenario where Seaver King is the third or fourth player off the board. It wouldn't surprise me in the least bit. And then as we look at this board, as we kind of jump into some guys that really stand out, guys that jumped up a lot, in the same vein as Seaver King, Kalen Culpepper, the shortstop over at Kansas State, jumped 23 spots to number 19 in this class. I just think, you know, you look at the player, you look at the tools. I mean, it's a huge arm. It's bat speed, it's speed, it's range, it's athleticism and physicality up the middle. He may not have the loudest slash line right now, but I do believe Kalen Culpepper is going to go early for a team looking for something like what the Astros had last year with Bryce Matthews. Like, yeah, it wasn't the loudest performance anybody has ever seen on the baseball field, but if it clicks, then he's going to be a really, really impressive player that not a lot of players can match. You know, we're talking about maybe a Kike Hernandez type 2.5-3 win player at the next level. William Schmidt jumps up 28 spots from 53 to 25, looking every bit that of a first-round high school arm. Billy Amick jumps 35 spots from 52 up to 27. Third baseman at Tennessee is showing a ton of power and a lot more defensive value than a lot of people gave him credit for coming into this season. I mean, I personally had in his blurb, Billy Amick is probably a first baseman. Since, you know, I've since changed the scouting report, I think he has a much better chance to play third base. Better chance than guys like Jacob Berry, Tyler Locklear, and Tommy White had when they were coming out of college. So he's been impressive. Still think it's a little bit of a grooved swing. I don't know whether Amick is going to be a necessarily decorated hitter at the next level. I think he has a hard time staying alive when he does chase outside of the zone. So something to track. I think my biggest riser on the college side, at least one that really stands out, Florida State outfielder / first baseman James Tibbs III, jumps 100 spots. 100 spots. He jumps from the fourth round, early fifth round even, to number 29, a projected late first round pick, maybe a compensatory pick. Listen, in terms of metrics, James Tibbs has been, if not the best player in the country, one of the best. It's like a 92% in-zone contact rate. It's like a 78% out-of-zone contact rate. The barrels are aplenty. The peak exit velos are enormous. I think teams will probably want the reassurance that he is capable of playing the outfield, which I have it in my blurb. Like, I think he's a left fielder. I don't think he's got a ton of range. He's a really thick, sturdy built kid. I don't think he's going to cover a lot of space, but he does have an above average throwing arm. So if you put him in the right position, he can end up being a pretty good player. I comped him to Seth Smith, formerly of the Rockies and of the Mariners. I think there's a little bit of that in this profile, and Seth Smith was a tremendous player. You get that at the end of the first round, you're pretty stoked. I do have Dallas Baptist righty Ryan Johnson up 66 spots from 97. I can't do the math. He's up 66 spots to number 31 in the class. Dude had a dead zone fastball last year, and although it was up to 99, it was hit around. It was all slider all the time for Johnson, and this year he's throwing absolute torpedo death bomb fastballs, 96 to 98, touching 99 with incredible sink. Incredible sink. I mean, just boring in on dudes. And the slider hasn't taken a step back whatsoever. I think Ryan Johnson looks every bit that of a big league starting pitcher and a probably a low number three at the next level. Also not walking anybody. So Ryan Johnson up into the first round range. Some high schoolers took a big jump in this class as well. I think teams are searching for dynamic athleticism, up the middle traits, tools. You know, they want someone that might have a high volatility level, but could develop into a full-time role five, role six guy. Kellen Lindsay is obviously the big one, up 267 spots to number 35. He was not ranked on the previous February 2nd top 300 board. He's been a pop-up. I mean, plain and simple, he's been a pop-up. He's getting Trey Turner comps, probably the fastest player in this draft, 80 grade runner he absolutely burns down the line. And if you're listening to this on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, whenever, I'll give you a quick look behind the curtain. Kellen Lindsay is going to be our guest on the Spotlight Show on Monday. You can see that at Future Star Series YouTube channel. Really, really interesting. Get humble beyond his means. I really liked how he came across. Wyatt Sanford up 53 spots to number 36. He's adding, he showed increased bat speed. Foot speed, more physicality, left-handed. A lot of people really high on Wyatt Sanford right now. And then you're going to see guys like Luke Holman. You're going to see Ryan Forcucci. You're going to see some of these college arms that have performed early. And while they may not be absolutely, you know, showing scouts that they're for sure first-rounders, they're certainly in the competition bucket right now. So that's where we're at. That's the new top 300. A little bit of a look forward. We will have a top 400 released in roughly 4.5 weeks from today, toward the end of April. Like I said, we will expand to 400 players, and the Stockwatch feature, of course, will return next week, March 28th, I believe. It could be March 27th. We'll see what the calendar looks like. We will be releasing the Future Star Series Plus top 100 college prospects for the 2026 MLB draft. And I'll just give you a bit of a headliner here. I do not have a college player number one in that class. I think it's going to be a good class, but there's a high schooler by the name of Grady Emerson that, boy, does he look like he has all of the tools in the bucket. Grady Emerson, a name to know. All right, so how's that? Not bad, right? Do a little bit more ASMR with the coffee. As we look forward here to this upcoming weekend, the weekend of the 21st through the 24th, not a great weekend for college baseball. I gotta say, it's a little bit quiet on the ranked matchups perspective, but there are a couple of good ones. And one in particular that I'm really excited about. So we'll jump into that first. And that's going to be Texas A&M and Mississippi State. Now, if you're listening to this on March 21st, Thursday, March 21st, hop over to your televisions pretty much right now. Mississippi State and Texas A&M play tonight at 6:30 Central at Bryan College Station. This is going to be a good one. This is going to be a really good one. A lot of ranked players in this matchup, a lot of draft prospects in this matchup, and it all starts at Mississippi State. Really, I mean, we can go and talk about Braden Montgomery. We've already done that, but let's start with Mississippi State. Dakota Jordan, outfielder, Mississippi State, arguably the most raw power in this class. It's enormous raw power. He's got an above average to plus throwing arm in right field. You know, I'm not sold that he's ever gonna hit, but I think he's gonna be a guy that's gonna go in the comp A or early second round. I believe he was number 49 on my top 300 update here. He's actually fallen 11 spots just because he hasn't proven that he can hit. But if you're looking for someone that is just an absolute tank and full of physical tools, Dakota Jordan, right fielder for Mississippi State, is every bit as much exciting as Braden Montgomery, just with more holes in his offensive game. Hunter Hines, the first baseman at Mississippi State, I currently have a fifth round grade on him. Enormous, enormous raw power from the left side. And then there is a host of arms for Mississippi State that are all going to get drafted this year. And this one actually really excites me. This is a team that I think is kind of sneaky when it comes to Omaha. But check this out. So you're going to get Nate Dome, who throws 99. I mean, it's an incredible arm. 6'3", 215, up to number 166, up from 180 on my last update, up 14 spots. Nate Dome, just a really, really good arm. You'll see him early in the series. Gerangelo Cinche, one of the biggest climbers in this update, up to number 124 from 203. He's up about 80 spots. He's the switch pitcher. Cinche is the one that's going to throw right-handed. He's going to throw left-handed. But the slider has taken an enormous step forward this year. And the fastball is once again 97 to 98 at peak. Just 5'11", 180 pounds. And then he'll flip over some nasty sliders and mid-90s heat from the left side too. But it gets better. Cal Steven is probably going to be either the Saturday or the Sunday guy. I know he's been rotating back and forth, but you know, he was a transfer in this year from Purdue, 6'4", 225 pounds, just a bulldog of a guy. Cal Steven was not on my first top 300 update in February because I wasn't that impressed with him at Purdue. Well, Cal Steven now in that sixth round range, fifth or sixth round range, about number 200 in the class for me on my board. And then it doesn't stop. I mean, Colby Holcomb is out there. He's probably going to get a ton of time on Sunday. Colby Holcomb has fallen a little bit on my board just because he hasn't gotten the amount of starts and innings that some of the other guys have. But Holcomb's another arm that's a pro arm, and he's going to be a good one. And then I'll give you a sleeper here. He was number 299 on my first board. He's up to 246, and I don't know if he has that much defensive value, to be honest with you, but Bryce Chance is a second baseman-ish at Mississippi State. He's probably going to DH. This dude hits everything. I mean everything. If you saw my tweet the other day about Joshua Kuroda Grauer, Bryce Chance was right next to him. So if you're looking for just a hitter's hitter hitter, Bryce Chance, Mississippi State. On the Texas A&M side, of course, Braden Montgomery up 12 spots in this update, which is kind of unheard of when you're already at 16. He jumps from 16 to 4 on the update. I've already talked about him. He's an insane talent. I think he's going to go really, really good in this draft. Ali Camarillo was 217 on my initial update. He has taken quite a big jump in this update as well. He's up to 177. He's improved his stock by about two rounds. Defense first, put the ball in play type of guy. There's almost no impact in his bat, but he is a steady Eddie defender with a little bit of projection left in that 6'1", 172-pound frame. There's a couple of arms at A&M as well that I really like. Chris Cortez will likely start on Sunday for the Aggies, and Troy Wansing will also probably get some considerable time this weekend. But the guy that I want to bring to your attention, and I talked about him a bit last week, is Ryan Prager. Wasn't on my original top 300. He's up to number 142, a potential fourth or fifth round lefty with a pitch design chart that you would look for in the pros. Gotta improve the strike quality. But he's a guy with an up arrow next to his name. And before last week, had some teams turning him in with second or third round grades. So that's a big one to keep track of. Texas A&M, Mississippi State. That was something like 9 or 10 pro prospects for the 2024 draft alone. So make sure to take that in. The other game that I'm watching this week is going to be Alabama and Auburn. And again, this series will start tonight in Auburn, Alabama, at 6 o'clock local time. Auburn and Alabama, we talked about Alabama a little bit last week. Ben Hess, their Friday guy, number 34 on my board, potentially a top 15 pick if he slams through the SEC. He's been really good. Pierce George is a right-handed reliever at Alabama, 6'7", up to 102 miles an hour this year. He's borderline in my top 100. But then they've got a lot of hitters out there at Alabama too. Ian Petritz, who's a third rounder on my board. Gage Miller, who isn't currently on my board, but has been one of the best players in the country this year. Just not a lot of physical tools with Gage Miller. Guys to watch there. Guys to watch. Alabama's got a really good team. And if you look at 2025 and 2026, they're pretty loaded out there too. But Auburn is a little bit less stacked. But there's one player in particular that I think you should keep an eye on. And that's outfielder Chris Stanfield. Stanfield jumped a ton. He jumped from number 311 to 84th on my recent top 300. Second or third round pick. Twitchy, explosive, outfield, can go and get it, can play center field. Chris Stanfield would be a guy that I would watch closely. He's got some of those traits that sneak up into the first round and could be a sneaky play for teams looking to capitalize on what is essentially a down year in up-the-middle dynamic impact type of players. Chris Stanfield with Auburn. Also Chase Alsup, their Friday night guy, 6'2", 213, up to 99 miles an hour. Can't go wrong there. So that's where I'm at, guys. You know, Arkansas and Auburn. Did I say Alabama to start this thing off? Wonderful. Wonderful. Absolutely knocked that out of the park. Well, if you want to watch Alabama, it's going to be on another channel. Arkansas brings Hagan Smith, Peyton Stovall, Brady Tiger, Mason Molina, Jared Spriglott, Hudson White, and a whole host of hogs in to face Auburn. I'm not even going to cut it out. This is what happens when teams in the same region all decide to have the same amount of characters in their school name that doesn't actually have the name of their state in it, and they all start with an A. I don't feel bad at all. So that's the T. All right, guys. Let's do this. The NL East, I know that's what you guys have been waiting for here. The NL East is, I mean, I would call it a competitive division. I think the Braves are the standout team in this one. But, you know, the Mets have so much money on that payroll, it's hard to ever dismiss them. The Phillies are, for my money, one of the best teams in baseball, built for October. And while they might only win 88 games, they'll get into the playoffs and they'll make a little bit of noise. And then there is the Miami Marlins. So let's start this thing off by talking about the Atlanta Braves. What kind of offseason did the Atlanta Braves have? Well, it was good, not great, but when you're already great, does it really, really matter? Does it really, really matter? Acquiring Chris Sale is such a championship move. It's such a championship move, and they didn't give up next to anything to get him. You add that to a rotation, if his body can withstand the rigors of Major League Baseball again, Atlanta's gonna have one of the best rotations in baseball. I think if you take Chris Sale, I think the big one for me, the question mark for me, and it's what a lot of people are going to ask coming into this episode, is the Jared Kelnick acquisition. Now, I preface this by saying they gave up almost nothing. You know, you take on the contracts of Marco Gonzalez to acquire Jared Kelnick. You do surrender Cole Phillips, who is now on his second Tommy John surgery. He has not thrown a professional pitch. He was drafted in, think 2022. And you give up Jackson Coar. So if Jared Kelnick can realize his potential and manifest what has been a breakout waiting to happen for the better part of, you know, 3 or 4 years now, it could go down as one of the biggest shellings of a trade in recent memory. I mean, if Jared Kelnick turns into a 4.5-5-win outfielder and they control him for 4 or 5 more years, the Braves, you know, will have fleeced Seattle in that deal. But with Adam Duvall already in Atlanta, Jared Kelnick already being informed he will be a platoon guy, I think the opportunity and the path toward that happening is pretty low. Ronaldo Lopez and Aaron Bummer are going to be two of the most underrated acquisitions of the entire offseason. I think they really round out what was already a pretty good bullpen. And even if they throw Ronaldo Lopez into the rotation, which I don't think they should do, it just points to how deep that staff is. So I give the Braves like a B plus. It was a really good offseason. They didn't give up next to anything, and they took shots on some guys. You know, one thing that's, I think, a little interesting about these acquisitions is Chris Sale and Jared Kelnick are guys that have been very, very intense. Very intense in the dugout. And for some teams, they can withstand that sort of personality, and some others cannot. And I think having an old school coach, an old school manager like Atlanta, they should probably be okay. They won't put up with that shit. So a good offseason for Atlanta. Nothing like incredibly splashy outside of the Chris Sale deal, who has red flags and question marks of his own. But a good offseason in Atlanta. Miami, on the other hand, I don't know what Miami's doing. I'll just put it out there. I don't know what they're doing. So you hire a Rays, you hire Peter Bendix from the Rays, right? Upgrade the front office, get it into a position where it can keep up with the rest of the league from a data and progressive standpoint. Well, I think what should have been taken from that Peter Bendix hire is they have no interest in spending money in Miami. And I would almost go as far as to say they regret the Avisail Garcia spend. They regret some of the other contracts from over the last couple of years that haven't worked out. And now they're just going to play it out. So while I think Bendix is going to do well for Miami, I don't think it's going to be this year. I mean, what exactly did they do? They signed Tim Anderson, which is great. I think Tim Anderson is the perfect bounce back candidate for the 2024 season. But the rotation as it stands today has AJ Puck in it, who was a closer last year. Yuri Perez is not going to start the season with the team. Sandy Alcantara is not going to start the season with the team. Max Meyer, not going to start the season with the team. And so on and so forth. Sixto Sanchez has been a nice story this spring training, but I don't know what this... You know, Jesus Luzardo is good, but he'll give you 1 day a week. So for the Miami Marlins not to go out and sign a couple of veteran starters, or not to go out and round out that lineup. Like we hear from Jazz Chisholm, oh, there's more accountability in Miami now. That's great, but is there more talent? I think this was it can't be a complete wash with Peter Bendix in the fold, because I think he's one of the best and brightest and truly an up-and-comer in this industry. And, you know, Miami also hired Frankie Pilier from Seattle to be their new scouting director, and that's going to be an enormous infusion in process for a draft organization that has at times not felt like they had an actual plan or process in the draft. I liked what they did last year with Thomas White and Noble Meyer, capitalizing on the high school pitching market when everyone else was paying attention otherwise. But this team needed help. This team was close enough to competing in 2024 that they should have continued to push their chips in, especially on one-year deals, and they didn't do it. That's frustrating to me as a baseball fan. So the New York Mets, David Stearns brought in. It's fine. Harrison Bader, G-Man Choi, Luis Severino, Sean Manaea, Diekman, Fujinami, Jorge Lopez, like those are a lot of good players, especially guys that you can flip in July. But it doesn't necessarily seem like New York is continuing to push their chips in to try and win a World Series after spending all that money over the last couple of years. Max Scherzer is no longer there. Justin Verlander is no longer there. I don't exactly know, you know, I'm trying to think of the name of their pitcher that's injured right now. Senga, Kodai Senga. I couldn't find it. Senga's going to be, you know, nobody knows when Senga's going to pitch again. So with Verlander gone, Scherzer gone, Senga, a gigantic question mark, even for the entire season, I would say. And Severino coming off what has been some up and down years in pinstripes. It's hard to imagine that the Mets are going to be better than they were last year. And with Pete Alonso in his contract year, I think there's just a lot up in the air for the Mets right now, especially as it pertains to their finances. So David Stearns inherited an organization that needs to be rebuilt from the farm up, from the player development side up. And the biggest thing that I would be looking at with the Mets this season that I'd be excited about was you're probably finally going to get a better look at some of these young players. Like the fact that they are finally giving Brett Beatty a shot to prove himself is going to be good for that organization. So it's probably a bridge year for the Mets. It was a fine. I mean, I'd give it like a C minus. Like it was a fine offseason. Nothing splashy, nothing bad, nothing necessarily good. But, you know, probably a 78 win team, the New York Mets. Now the Phillies, on the other hand, I like what the Phillies did. I mean, you get a homegrown dude by retaining Aaron Nola. You get a homegrown dude by extending Zach Wheeler. Now that's $300 million, don't get me wrong. And that's probably not going to age well 3 or 4 years from now. But if the Phillies want to win a World Series, they're going to have to do it with Aaron Nola and Zach Wheeler. And that's probably going to come, if it's going to come, in the next three seasons. Bryce Harper's not getting any younger. The core around Bryce Harper isn't necessarily getting much younger either. This is a team built to win a World Series now. And I think while 2029 and 2030... 2028, 2029, 2030 may not be good years in Philadelphia. I think people would agree with that. You're going to have a lot of old contracts in Philadelphia in 29 and 30. I think they're doing the right thing by going for it while they can. So kudos to Dombrowski. No splashy moves outside of that, but they did what they needed to do. And finally, if you ask me, with what the Washington Nationals have done with Steven Strasburg, that is a mark over the organization right now that really needs to come to an end. Because it's a terrible look for an organization that is treating a homegrown guy who just wants to retire into the sunset. They're treating him like crap. And I know there's two sides of the story, but just let the guy walk. You know, pay him the contract that you signed him up for and let him walk. But the thing with the Nationals is you're looking at 2025, and it's hard not to be incredibly excited about the Washington Nationals with Dylan Cruz and James Wood and Brady House and all of these prospects that are set to arrive, if not this year, early next year. Joey Gallo, Nick Senzel, Eddie Rosario, Jesse Winker, all fine lottery tickets. They could turn into something that you can move at the deadline, or if they all click at the same time and you bring up James Wood and Dylan Cruz early this season, maybe you've got a team that's a little bit better than people expected, though I do think they're short on the pitching that would be necessary to actually compete in this division. This all points to 2025 for me, and I think you try and fix Jesse Winker and flip him for something. You try and fix Joey Gallo or get what Joey Gallo is and flip him at the deadline to a contender. And maybe you strike lightning in a bottle with Nick Senzel, who has always been toolsy, but he just seems to get dinged up and hurt a little bit. So that's that's where things are at there. So my prediction, I'll get to my prediction in a minute, but let's talk about the one player in this division that can make the biggest difference, that can, as my friend Colby Patnode says, that can seesaw the division. The one guy that can put a team on his back and just change the outcome of the division entirely. For me, I think it's Trey Turner. Turner is going on year three now. It might be year two. 2023 felt like a long season. Might be year two. Trey Turner is the type of guy that if he can get hot for an entire season and hit 350, steal 35 bags, hit 20 bombs, and play a good shortstop in Philadelphia, he's the type of guy that can set the table for a Schwarber, for a Harper, for a Castellanos, for guys that lead a team to scoring 5.5 runs a game. And I think if Turner gets hot with the pitching that they already have in Philadelphia, I think they could win 96 to 98 games. I do. But without that table setting force at the top, and don't give me the Kyle Schwarber should lead off. I hate that. What's the point? What's the point of having Trey Turner if you're going to bat him behind a guy that's station to station? That doesn't make any sense to me. So Trey Turner's the guy that I think could not single-handedly win this division for the Phillies, but could win this division for the Phillies. Maybe the Braves rotation slumbers a bit and Turner is the MVP version of Trey Turner. That's what I'd be looking for this year. And I think it's probably a two-horse race. I think you've got two 94 to 96 win teams here. I think the Atlanta Braves are every bit that of a 94, 95 win team, maybe better than that, depending on how some of these pawns at the back end of that lineup kind of line out. You know, if Jared Kelnick hits, maybe it's a 97 win team. The Phillies, again, you know, this is a team that could win 87 games again, but could go to the World Series. I personally think this is the year that the Phillies have, they stress a bit more urgency in the regular season and they win 94 to 96 games. I think it's a two-horse race. I think the Mets will probably come in third. I've got the Mets winning 78 games. I have the Marlins winning 76 games. You know, listen, it's not that I don't believe in Miami. It's that they don't have enough offense to sustain the injuries that this rotation has been overcome by. And I do have the Nationals finishing fifth, though it wouldn't surprise me if the Nationals finished as high as third, if an infusion of young talent kind of, I guess, is the appetizer for what could be a very, very fun 2025 season. We'll leave it with this. The NL East, and I don't like doing this, but who's on the hot seat? Well, it's not Alex Anthopoulos in Atlanta. I'll tell you that right now. It's not Peter Bendix in Miami. I'll tell you that right now. It's certainly not David Stearns in New York. I'll tell you that right now. And for my money, it's probably not Dave Dombrowski in Philadelphia. Dave Dombrowski is there for one reason. It's to bring in the best talent and to put a winner on the field every year. And I have a hard time seeing any situation outside of the Phillies cratering and winning 78 games to where that ownership group would say, let's bring in someone new. I mean, I think everyone realizes the roster in place is going to be the roster in Philadelphia for the foreseeable future. Not a lot of additions on the horizon for Philadelphia in the coming years. Not with where that payroll's at. So that takes me to Washington. I'm a huge Mike Rizzo fan. The Steven Strasburg contract left a mark on Mike Rizzo's reputation, I guess would be one way of saying it. He did walk away from Anthony Rendon, which ended up being a really good move for him. But they lost Bryce Harper, who's been a superstar in their division, and he's been there a very long time. Now, I look at Mike Rizzo like this. He comes from a scouting background. He's put together a beautiful farm system. We all keep in mind, he also moved Juan Soto. Got a ransom for him, though he did a wonderful job there. But Mike Rizzo, by virtue of having been there for so long, that I think if the Nationals come out and they win 69 to 71, 72 games, maybe a change takes place. I don't see it. The Nationals are very loyal to their leadership. Davey Martinez just got a big contract extension. I don't see any of those guys going anywhere. So I wouldn't say any of these leadership cogs have any sort of any sort of warmth underneath their seat. No, nobody's on the hot seat in the NL East. But if things really go awry, if things really fall apart, the Washington Nationals are probably the organization that would have to look in the mirror and say, where's this going? And maybe the strength of the farm system keeps Mike Rizzo there inherently anyways. So that's where I'm at. Trey Turner, most important player in this division. Mike Rizzo, not a great chance that he gets let go, but probably the closest thing to a hot seat you can find in the NL East. And the Atlanta Braves, once again, with 95 wins, win the NL East over the Philadelphia Phillies. Although, like I said, it's going to be close. That'll do it. Another episode of the Lonely FSS Plus podcast. I hope you enjoyed this ASMR version of my diary journal in the baseball industry. Until next time, see ya. So just chill till the next episode.